Good morning. This is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss, and my guest on today's show is Kirk Johnson, sound director of the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History. More importantly, for our purpose today, Johnson serves as resident scientist and on-screen narrator for Walrus, Life on Thin Ice, the documentary that airs October 22nd. That's 3 weeks from today. And the season premiere of Nature, the long-running PBS series. A paleontologist by a current profession, Johnson mentions in the film that he's worked in the 1980s as a marine geologist investigating the feeding grounds of walruses, recalling his initial glimpse at a wall of walruses on and around Round Island, the oldest wildlife sanctuary in Alaska, by the way. He remembers it was love at first sight. That affection is apparent throughout the doc, which is fundamentally an exploration of the impact of climate change on walruses, particularly shrinking sea ice, given the way they rely on that ice for feeding, breeding, and more. But Walrus Life on Thin Ice definitely cobbles together an illuminating profile of the animal, including that walruses have air sacs in their throats that enable them to sleep while floating on the water. Some walruses can and do eat 5,000 clams a day. And in tracking the story of rehabilitating an orphan walrus calf dubbed Little Miss Walrus, it turns out there are only four permanent facilities in the U.S. that house walruses, and one with the largest population of these tusked mammals is SeaWorld Orlando. We'll hear this discussion about walruses, the nature doc, Walrus Life on the Thin Ice, and more when I play back my conversation with Kirk Johnson, recorded yesterday, in just a moment here on Talking Animals on WNF. First, though, an important programming note. In just 1 week, October 8th, WNF's Fall Fund Drive begins, and I'll be raising money on Talking Animals on that very day, Wednesday, October 8th. Typically assigned a sizable fundraising goal, especially for a one-hour show, and learned over the years that the only real prospect of reaching that kind of goal is to get a head start, receive pledges before the fund drive show. So I'm hoping you might consider donating, ideally in the next day or two, certainly before October 8th. Any amount will be greatly appreciated. As always, we have exclusive Talking Animals thank you gifts for pledges of various levels, ranging from amazing tickets to Peter Frampton at Ruth Eckert Hall on October 31st to glow-in-the-dark dog collars for more safely walking your dog at night or early in the morning. So please visit WMF.org, and in the upper right-hand corner, click on Donate Now. Just follow those prompts, and then when there's a drop-down menu, please try to select Talking Animals, TLA, so that our show is credited with your donation. Thank you so much. Meanwhile, coming up later on today's show, I'll speak with Amy Crosby, St. Francis Society Animal Rescue, both about the work they do day-to-day and an upcoming event called Perfect that will benefit St. Francis. Perfect involves a night of live music, comedy, dance, improv, and a costume party November 1st at the studio at the Carrollwood Cultural Center. We'll learn more details when Amy Crosby speaks with us later in today's show. Right now, though, let's hear the conversation all about walruses and the new edition of the PBS series Nature that explores various aspects of walrus lives, including their shrinking sea ice. The man at the center of that episode, Kirk Johnson. Recorded yesterday, this is my conversation with Kirk Johnson on Talking Animals on WMNF. So let's welcome to Talking Animals, Kirk Johnson. Thanks for joining us on Talking Animals, Kirk.
Hey, my pleasure. Good to meet you, Duncan.
Likewise. So this film is barely underway when it becomes clear you've obviously had a long-time crush on walruses. We'll certainly come back to your pretty observable affection, as the doc itself does. But for now, tell me what first appealed to you about walruses.
You know, when I was 25 years old, I had the good fortune to be on a research vessel in the Bering Sea. And we went ashore on Round Island on a beautiful, sunny June day. And there were about 10,000 walruses laid out on the beach. And I'd never seen a walrus before in my life. I was only 25 years old, and I thought everybody got to see walruses. And over the last 40 years, I realized I was one of the few people in the world that have seen walruses. It's like, so if they've been part of my world for almost 40 years now. And when I saw them, I couldn't believe what I was seeing, these 3,000-pound animals with two big ivory tusks just stacked cordwood on a beach. And they smelled like pigs. And it was just an amazing thing to watch these animals. And I... you know, from then on, I've started paying attention to anything walrus. And one of the things I noticed was that everybody knows what a walrus is, but very few people have seen live, wild Pacific walrus.
Yeah, it does seem like a rare thing, and that's part of what this film sort of provides. A nice, it's not quite being with a walrus in person, but it's the next best thing, given all the walrus that pop up in different settings in the film and stuff. So were you surprised how taken you were with walruses back then when you were first on this initial research trip?
Oh, yeah. I mean, like, I never even thought about a walrus. I mean, I just, you know, most people, in fact, when I talk about walrus, they don't even make the distinction between a walrus and an elephant seal or a big seal or a sea lion. And they're just such unusual animals. And their connection to the native cultures in northwestern Alaska and in eastern Siberia is really amazing. There are people that have hunted walruses for thousands of years, and they've carved amazing things out of ivory walrus tusks. And their clothing, they have leather or white fur pellets that look like walrus tusks themselves. And so there's this whole connection of people and walrus that I'd never been exposed to. And unlike most marine mammals, here's one where there's a deep archaeological connection between people and walruses, and the whole sense that these people feed themselves a walrus and they think of themselves as walrus people. And it the whole thing kind of blew my mind. And I kept dreaming of going back and seeing that same place again. And this PBS show gave me the chance to do that. And in the intervening 40 years or so, I learned a lot about walrus, did a lot of research on them. And they're enigmatic, wonderful, really cool animals that come together in vast herds. And it kind of reminiscent of the herds of bison that used to be on the plains. So you have these herds of literally tens of thousands of 3,000-pound animals. And it's just a wildlife sight to behold.
So even as you were kind of pursuing a path towards paleontology, you sound like you were always had your hand in the walrus world, as it were.
Yeah, you know, what happened was I was a college senior and I wanted to be a paleontologist, but I'd gotten an internship at the U.S. Geological Survey. And I gave first choice paleontology, second choice marine biology because they had to make three choices. And I got picked up by the Alaska branch of the U.S. Geological Survey and spent 2 years doing research on the Bering Sea and the animals that feed on the seafloor. So there's not just walruses that feed on the seafloor, but also gray whales feed on animals that are in the seafloor. So this whole idea that big marine mammals are actually sucking up food from the bottom of the ocean was also new to me. And it gave me a really cool couple year run in the science of marine geology and marine mammalogy and marine biology. And then I went back to being a paleontologist for the rest of my career. So it's always been sort of a sidelight, but a really cool one.
Yeah, it's interesting because when I first was hearing about the film and reading a little bit about it, I thought, okay, paleontologist, walrus, not to mention one that oversees one of the nation's largest natural history collection, that may or may not shout, here's the guy to anchor your walrus film. But that's because I didn't know about your background and your longstanding kind of almost like a side pursuit as you pursued your initial career, primary career in paleontology.
Yeah, it was sort of like a nice little sidelight. And of course, what happens on later on is there's a whole fossil story of walruses as well. So the two things do kind of dovetail together. And in the show, we end up looking at fossil walrus from San Diego, which is not where you'd expect to find a fossil walrus.
Yeah. Well, I'm as with all these things, I'm always a little concerned about hitting spoilers for people who haven't seen the film yet. But that seems like an important thing just because it looks at the kind of the future and sort of what for many will be a surprising past of walruses in terms of what's going to happen next and what's happened in the past, because I don't think a lot of people would expect there was warm water walrus in San Diego, but sure enough. So
they are.
So this is Talking Animals on WNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest is Kirk Johnson, a prominent paleontologist who serves as the on-screen narrator for Walrus, Life on Thin Ice, a documentary that airs October 22nd in the season premiere of Nature, the long-running PBS series. This interview was recorded yesterday. So for years, we've heard and seen various concerns expressed about polar bears and diminishing ice, but to what extent do you feel walruses are flying under the radar when it comes to those similar kind of concerns?
You know, very much so. The walrus is distinctly an ice animal, and the way it works is they use ice floes to float around in the Bering Sea and the Chukchi Sea, and they can rest and sleep on the ice, and then they dive down to the seafloor, which is usually not that deep, anywhere from like 20 feet to a couple hundred feet, and find the clams as their primary food source, or clams in the seabed. And so you imagine they're floating along on ice floes. They're basically floating over a giant kind of seafood smorgasbord, and they don't have to do much swimming, and they can rest with their young, the walrus pups, and move along. And the population is this really cool thing where the females and pups float north on ice floes, and the males stay south in the open water in the summer. And so the population splits, males and females split in the spring and summer and come back together in the fall and winter. And we've lost something like a third of the summer sea ice in the last 40 years due to, you know, increased warming and increased albedo of the Arctic Ocean. So we're in the time between when I saw walrus the first time in 1985 and now 40 years later, we've lost fully a third of the summer sea ice. And so that's clearly got an impact on the walrus because they're so tied to sea ice. And we try and unravel that story in the show.
Yeah, it's obviously really important to them for feeding, for breeding, for all kinds of things. So it seems kind of dire the way it's shaping up and moving so quickly to that reduction of sea ice. I don't know what your level of optimism is about the longer term prospects for walruses, given the diminishing sea ice situation.
Well, there's sort of two things I think about it. One is the fossil record of walrus is really interesting. It goes back several million years, but even with the modern walrus, Odobenus rosmarsus, there are Ice Age walruses, and we find their skulls and skeletons in places like Vancouver and in off the coast of Massachusetts, all the way down to North Carolina. So in colder periods of the Ice Age, walruses were down at mid-latitudes. And then if you go back like 5, 6, 7, 8 million years, when there was no real polar ice, there were warm water walruses in San Diego. So I think when I look at walruses, I don't use the word dire necessarily, because it's clear that the walrus have had an ice-free past. So they might be able to be just fine in an ice-free future, which, you know, it's unlike the polar bear, who's an animal who's so adapted to living on ice and hunting on the ice that lack of sea ice is going to turn sea bear into a land bear. But in the case of the walrus, you know, there's plenty of pinnipeds that live in non-polar regions or in non-nice situations. So I'm kind of optimistic that they might be adaptable in that sense. And the big change is going to be in the population size. And what we're seeing now is these immense gatherings of walrus hauling out on beaches. And there are places in the coast of Siberia now where there are many tens of thousands of walrus in one single beach. And so there's a couple things. One is that back in 1985, we estimated the walrus population at about 250,000. And today we estimate the walrus population at about 250,000, which means there might be no change at all in the walrus population, or we didn't know how to count them very well 40 years ago. And now with satellites and better counting, you know, maybe we're looking at 250,000 that descended from 500,000, and we just named the right number back in 1985. So there's a little bit of ambiguity about how stressed they are. They are hauling out on beaches a lot more, which creates a lot of infant mortality, because the big 3,000 males can easily crush a 100-pound pup.
Really, just by accident, kind of rolling over on the...
I mean, some of the scenes of the show you these just vast beaches full of, you know, the big adult males and the big moms, and then these little tiny babies are like, you know, imagine taking a toddler to a sumo wrestling match or something like that. It's not even a fair fight.
Yeah, the tracking the walrus population, it seems like it's, I guess what you're saying is it might have been more imprecise than people realized, or is it improbable that it really hasn't changed at all from that first survey or population count in 1985?
Well, you know, it seems improbable to me that it hasn't changed. I agree with you on that one. So I kind of am assuming that there was a higher population then, and we just didn't have the ability to count them. Because, you know, now we can count walrus from satellites. You can actually pick out individual walruses. And they've been using walruses in captivity at SeaWorld in San Diego to measure walrus body shapes to be able to identify them with satellites. So it's you know, in many ways easier to count them now you might get a more accurate count. On the other hand, there's still an awful lot of walrus up there. And I look at them, and I think the analogous thing for me is that the bison of the Western Plains that went from many millions in their population in the 1860s, 1870s, by 1883, they're almost entirely gone. So we do know that polar animals do go through crash and burn cycles where they mate up and have lots and lots of babies and then get large population sizes and then crash because the resources are also on sort of a boom and crash cycle. That's been documented for caribou and things like that. But the walrus question is still, I think, sort of open for debate and really interesting.
Yeah, well, and also I think using much lower tech methods, as far as I can tell, part of the film spends a little time introducing us to two wardens who spend the spring and summer living on Round Island, conducting sort of a daily census, I guess, of walrus arrivals and departures, and thereby arriving at an overall tally. And seems like a good gig, you know.
Yeah, no, those the two ladies that were there were just having the life of Riley. They lived in this beautiful little cabin on this island far out into the Bering Sea, and every morning they either go down to the sea lion side of the island and count sea lions, or the walrus side of the island and count walrus. And they just seemed to be kind of in this state of bliss, and it was really fun. We spent a week there, actually camped out on the shores in awful weather. But you know, waking up in the morning, I was camped on a little tent platform about 40 yards from the edge of this cliff. And in the morning, the walrus would wake me up with their noises and the amazing sounds they make.
Yeah, well, are they using kind of just, compared to what you described before about the sort of increasingly high-tech methods available, are they using just their own just sort of spotting of walrus or sea lion, as case may be, to arrive at their count?
Yeah, they literally go out and sit on on the side of the hill with binoculars and just count the number of animals they see. And they do have a couple of fixed cameras as well. And I think some of those, those cameras you can go watch wildlife on, there is a Round Island walrus cam. And that's an amazing thing because it's almost like being there. And so on really bad weather days, they can't get out to the overlook places, they'll work off the cameras. But they do a daily tally of both the walruses and the sea lions. And it's pretty amazing because they come and go with some great frequency.
Well, also, I would be impressed because it seems like, at least to just a lay person like me watching the film, being able to tell that many walrus apart, like, is that walrus 222 or is that walrus 223? I can't really tell, but I don't know how you tally that number. And they must have incredible eye or must really be precise in terms of the characteristics that distinguish one walrus from the next.
Well, I don't think they can actually do that very well. I mean, the obvious thing to see is body size and tusk size, shape, orientation, or if the tusks are broken off. But they're not identifying unique animals. They're just sort of saying, here's a pile of walrus.
Oh, here's the number today. Not necessarily there's more or less or different ones than we saw yesterday morning at this time.
Exactly.
I got you. Okay. When you talked about pups and the danger of a big walrus rolling over, I was really interested. The film kind of episodically tells the story of how orphaned walrus calves are rescued and rehabilitated by sort of focusing on the recovery of an orphan dubbed Little Miss Walrus.
Yeah.
And which I thought was great right off the bat. But we, over time, over the course of telling that story, learned there are only four permanent facilities in the U.S. for orphans that, I guess, basically can't be released back into the wild.
Right.
And the one with the most walruses is SeaWorld Orlando. So that's where Little Miss Walrus, now, I guess, renamed Uki, was sent and now lives. So it was a pretty interesting story. And I think people might be surprised, especially some animal types that maybe listen to this show or whatever, that kind of take a dim view of SeaWorld just because of, you know, orcas and other things and certain, but they have a whole other rescue element that's long been sort of very highly regarded. And this kind of points to that, I guess, because that was the place they selected out of the four candidates to send this particular orphan.
Yeah, you know, the thing about it is that those little baby walrus stick with their moms for 2 years and they drink mother's milk. And so if they get separated, they can't function on their own at all. And their bodies grow really rapidly. That little Miss Walrus was, you know, less than 100 pounds when she came ashore up by Barrow, Alaska. And then 8 months later, she was 340 pounds after she, put in the Seward Sea Life Center in Alaska, then transferred down to Orlando. And they really bulk up fast because I was impressed that she went from 100 pounds to 340 pounds in the time that we were filming the show.
That's impressive weight gain.
And, you know, the thing about it is that keep a walrus get large, like a male walrus can go up to 3,500 pounds. So keeping an animal like that in captivity, the big elephants, I mean, the big walruses they have at SeaWorld all started there, not as captured large walrus, but as orphan babies. They lived their whole life in SeaWorld Orlando. They would have not been able to survive in the wild. So it's not a rehabilitation. It's just sort of preserving the lives of individual animals and letting them be ambassadors for walrus, which are seldom seen. That's the amazing thing. Even in Alaska, you ask people who've seen a wild walrus, and most Alaskans haven't been to those remote places in the Bering Sea or the Chukchi Sea where you can see a live walrus. So they're special.
It was special. And one of the many things that was great, and this kind of ran throughout the film, is your own ongoing enthusiasm. Like, you were so excited because when you had done that initial experiment in the 80s, you had seen walrus, but not out on the ice, not out in the water per se. And you were like almost giddy. Here was a chance to actually see them in that setting. And I thought, this is a guy who's a true walrus fan and got big passion for it. So
yeah, it's funny the things you get into and get, you know, you sort of take, but I always have favorites, and walrus has been sort of the animal that's really been most interesting to me for my whole life. And they are fascinating animals. Imagine these are animals that use their tusks for a variety of things, but not what you usually read about. You usually read that they go down and use their tusks to dig out clams to the seabed. But what they actually are doing is using their mouth to jet water out and excavate clams. And then they grab the clams to their lips and suck the clam meat out of the clam shell and discard the clam shell. So when you can look at the stomach contents of a walrus, it'll be clam meat, but no clam shells. And they're able to do that because their mouth is shaped in a way that lets them jet water when they're shooting water out, but it has huge suction when they're sucking in, and they can use their mouth sort of like pumps to pump water out to find the clams and then suck in to suck the meat out of the shell. So they're a kind of animal known as a suction feeder. And you can see this really well when you go to SeaWorld. When they're feeding them, they'll bring out a bucket of 20 pounds of clam meat, and the walrus are just like giant vacuum cleaners. They just suck the clam meat right into their mouths.
Wow. Well, you know, that one of the things that, since we're on the topic of clams, these guys really love their clams. I mean, I know some people who truly love clams, but I'm pretty sure a few of them have ever consumed 5,000 clams in a day, the way I guess walruses routinely do. So, I mean, again, back to sort of our concern about shrinking sea ice and the impact of climate change more broadly, to what degree is that kind of clam consumption sustainable given some of the other changes that have happened in their environment?
Well, I think what's impressive was that it historically it was sustainable, that the sea floor of the Bering Sea, those shallow shelf seas up in the Arctic area, Chukchi Sea and the Bering Sea, are incredibly productive. That, you know, there's the amount of benthic productivity, the not just the clams, but crabs and amphipods and sea cucumbers and other kinds of marine organisms are, it's just a really rich area because of the nutrient flow through the area. And it's productive enough to support not just huge herds of walrus, but also tens of thousands of gray whales and other whales that flow through that area. And what's changing now is the dynamics of the Bering Sea, where you have less sea ice. And ironically, what that does is that means there's less sea ice algae, which is one of the drivers of the benthic productivity. So as you melt away the sea ice, you'll probably have a world where you can still be a walrus, but you can't have as many walrus. It's more like a shrinking resource.
Because there won't be enough to feed that many, you mean?
Yeah, we're seeing that now with the gray whales, the California gray whale, which feeds in the same waters as does the Pacific walrus up in the Bering Sea, just south of the Bering Straits. Those whales will migrate up from their breeding grounds in Baja every every spring, and they go up into the Bering seafloor, and they go down to the seafloor and vacuum up patches of the seafloor mud that has these little amphipods in these mucus tube mats. And a big, you know, big gray whale can consume literally hundreds of pounds of amphipods a day. And they fill themselves up. And then they, with that energy, they swim all the way back down to California, mate, have their babies, and swim all the way back up to Alaska the following summer. And what we've seen in the last couple of years are these, what are called UMEs, or unexplained mortality events, where a number of gray whale carcasses wash ashore, either in Oregon or Washington or British Columbia or Alaska. And they're skinny. They basically starve to death. So they had enough food to go from Alaska all the way down to Baja and start the way back, but they basically starve to death on the way back to Alaska. So you can see that evidence there that they're sort of draining the food resource. There's not as many amphipods in the seafloor as there were 20 years ago. And it's expressing itself in the death of skinny whales along the coastline of the western coast.
So at the moment, it's kind of more overt with the gray whales and some of them that have gotten skinny and died off, I guess. Because yeah. I've been fortunate enough a few times to be the successful end, I guess, or one part of that where they're in Baja California in the San Ignacio Lagoon. That whole phenomenon of friendly whales is a pretty fascinating thing. But it sounds...
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's so cool is you can go down to Baja in the winter, and then in the summer you go up to Nome, Alaska, and there's the same whales. They're up there, but up in Nome, they're just feeding like you wouldn't believe it. If we took a plane out, and there's a brief shot of it in the show, but we had a lot of really cool footage taken from a plane of feeding gray whales from the air, and those are amazing animals. They literally are sucking up, their suction feeders, just like the walrus, they're sucking up a lot of seafloor. And when they come to the surface breathing out, they're just sending plumes of muddy water as they push the water through their baleen and retain the little amphipods that they eat.
You know, I wondered, and it's probably kind of a dopey question as I think about it now, but again, when the whales' moms and their calves are in Baja California, especially in the San Ignacio Lagoon, this whole phenomenon of the friendly whales where literally you're in like a little skiff and the moms bring the calves up to you to pet them and meet them and whatever. And I just wondered if at any other point in their journey, would they ever be that inclined, or is it so specific to San Ignacio and just having had those babies and just keeping an eye on them? But it seems so counterintuitive when you know how mom animals of all different kinds go nuts when you get too close to their baby, and this is like they're bringing them over to introduce you. And I just wondered if there'd ever be a situation where they'd be outside of the lagoon where they might be similar.
You know, when we were doing research on the gray whales, we did a lot of work along the coast of British Columbia, because some of the whales do stop and do a little bit of bottom feeding along the ways. And there's no great big patches of amphipods like there are in the Bering Sea, but along the coast of Vancouver Island and the west coast of Washington State, you do see these whales poking along the coastline and feeding in shallow waters. And you often see gray whales right up against the edge of the surf almost. They're in super shallow water. That makes them one of the more visible whales. But my recollection is they were never as friendly there as they were down in Baja. And there must be something about the calves are young. They're just being sort of brought into the herd and doing things that are unique. And I've watched, probably as you as well, the increase of orca attacks on the northbound gray whales, where they're going after the calves and trying to separate the calves from the mom. So it's all friendly down in Baja, but then it gets a little bit more challenging as they make that trip back up to Alaska.
Yeah. So I'd be curious to know, I mean, what this film, to me, among other things, although it does have kind of a fundamental theme that it explores in terms of the impact of climate change and how the sea ice has been affected. But there's really, it's kind of ultimately a mosaic. Tells a lot of stories and covers a lot of ground, and we meet a lot of cool animals and people along the way. What kind of hand did you have in helping shape that, as opposed to, obviously, you're kind of our narrator and guide for sure? But
Well, you know, it was a very personal story because it was my story of encountering the walrus when I was a young man, and now 40 years later, I'm working. And I've been doing a lot with Nova PBS, and my shows. You know, I served as the sort of the presenter of the show and introduced the show, and I typically do shows that are in sort of the zone of my research. My research is focused on polar ecosystems and ancient forests and change in landscapes and time over time. And so being able to put this story into that thing is definitely like the elements are there. But I work with Windfall Films out of London. I've done a number of shows with them, and they're really good at chatting with me about the general ideas I have and then building TV-worthy narratives out of those pieces. So, you know, usually I come with the ideas and then hand them over to Dave Dugan and his crew, and they figure out the shoots and the sequence and how to edit the whole thing together. And you know, often we shoot things out of sequence, and so they're those smart ones who are saying, like, on this cliff on Round Island, we want you to be talking about this aspect because we know it fits into the film. So usually when we're shooting, I'm more of a following instructions kind of guy. But when we're talking about it, I'm like, here's my idea, here's my vision. And they're like, well, here's how we achieve that vision. So it's been a wonderful partnership, but you really love working with the film crews on these things. Usually it's small film crew, one or two cameras, a sound guy, and you know, maybe four people all told. And we get ourselves into some pretty gnarly conditions trying to get the shots. And it's so great to be out on the ice. In, you know, on the ice floes, the walrus, or on the islands we're holding out. I mean, it's really such a privilege to be able to see these animals up close, and you know, just my fascination with them has only grown by making the show. I got to say that.
Yeah, well, it really came through because, I mean, you talked about it being really personal, and that's one of the things I think that makes this film so appealing is that you obviously had a long time love and passion for these, but you're related to that, you feel very protective of them. And that really comes through with exploring some of the issues that are central to the film.
You think it stands as a good sequel to My Octopus Teacher?
Exactly, yeah. No, but I mean, one of the things that, like I say, when I mentioned earlier about almost like a mosaic, because there's so many elements to this film. So it's obviously they're pretty much all about walrus, of course. Mm-hmm. But I mean, they're covering a lot more ground, and it's really interesting, and it's hard not to be, I think, brought into that as someone who didn't maybe know as much about walrus, but found them enchanting and learned a lot. So in fact, as we're sort of nearing the end of our time here, Kirk. By the way, let me just say one more time, this is Talking Animals on WNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. I'm speaking with Kirk Johnson, a paleontologist who oversees the collection at the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History and is the on-screen narrator for Walrus Life on Thin Ice, a documentary that airs October 22nd. That's the season premiere of the PBS series Nature. So this interview was recorded yesterday. So for listeners of the show who obviously tend to be animal people, of course, what can we do as in the face of the administration that mocks and dismisses climate change, since climate change is so much a part of this? Are any steps that we can take? I mean, I think by the end of watching this film, people will feel like you did, that we love walruses and feel protective of them, but want to do something if possible.
Well, I think that the real answer is that, you know, the world's a complicated and wonderful place. And that's what we strive to do at the Natural History Museum, is to tell the millions of stories that make our planet what it is. And I do really feel that the very first step is awe and wonder. And the second step is kind of like melding yourself to a love of the natural world. And then every place is different. Every solution is different. But I always think that the work I do, I hope to help people increase their awareness and love of the natural world. And then there are thousands of things that everybody can do in their own, wherever they live, to help steward the planet and realize that the wild world is still out there in an increasingly populated planet with myriad different challenges to wild animals. The fact that we can shoot a film in Alaska and see thousands of walrus still gives me a lot of hope. And I do think that as in my deep time perspective, watching animals wax and wane over the millions of years that they've been on the planet, is that as climate changes, animals do adapt, and evolution and adaptation happens at a very fast rate. And even when we're having rapid climate change, you'll see rapid adaptation. And we end the film with a pretty positive note, I think, because it shows that there are many ways to think of these things. And ultimately, I think television is a great way to get people thinking about what's out in the planet. And there are, not to give you a specific answer to your question, but just to say that there are lots of ways that people can be advocates for nature. And I think that's so important. And that's one of the reasons I love doing television, is that people get to the sense of going there themselves, but, know that these animals need supporters.
Yeah. And it's great, because even if you're already kind of an animal or nature person, there's an opportunity to connect in a different way with, like, in the wake of the Walrus film. It's like, I always kind of liked walruses and thought they were kind of cool looking, but I didn't know anything about them until this film by comparison. So I feel
was the goal. I'm glad it worked with you, at least.
For sure. Well, that's one. Yeah, we're keeping
excellent. <forward.
laughs> Yeah. So one last question. This is actually off topic, Kurt, but in that you're someone overseeing a major Smithsonian museum, I'm pretty curious to know how you felt when the president announced it would review the Smithsonian's exhibitions and might seek changes to certain content. How did you react? And what about your colleagues?
Well, I'm quite confident in the Smithsonian's ability to be a persistent part of our nation. We're the nation's first investment in science. And, the key thing about the Smithsonian is we exist for all Americans. We're nonpartisan. We're apolitical. We welcome every single person in the country. And in fact, 85% of our visitors are American citizens from all across the country. So we're a nonpolitical entity, and we hope to remain that as we move forward.
All right. Well, that sounds good. More evidence, perhaps, that still that we might be better served by a walrus running the country.
Well, I've got a lot of faith in walruses.
Yeah, they could do it. They could do it for sure. All right. Well, we've kind of completed our time. We've been speaking with Kurt Johnson. Again, the film is Walrus Life on Thin Ice. Debuts on the 22nd of October on PBS Nature. Thanks so much for making the time to join us today on Talking Animals, Kirk, and thanks for all your great work over all these years, walrus-related and other-related as well.
Thanks a lot, Duncan. Great to meet you.
Thank you.
My thanks again to Kirk Johnson for that conversation. In a moment, I'll speak with Amy Crosby of St. Francis Society Animal Rescue, hearing both about the rescue itself and an upcoming event that will benefit St. Francis called Perfect, featuring live music, comedy, dance, improv, and a costume party, slated for November 1st, Halloween weekend, at the studio at the Carrollwood Cultural Center. More on that in a moment on Talking Animals on WNF. Right now, though, we're going to step into the Comedy Corner with a piece from a longtime favorite, Joe Zimmerman, and this one's called Bird Watching, in today's Comedy Corner on WNF.
Yeah, so I don't feel old, but I did recently identify a bird. That can't be good. Is that a whippoorwill? Why do I care? And why do I have binoculars? My bird book says it is a whippoorwill. Yes. Got it. Good thing I've been studying. Yeah, I got into birding over the pandemic. I went down to Central Park. At first I did it ironically. I was like, I'm so stupid. Got too much time. 2 hours later, I'm like, Martha, look at that owl. She's like, that's a robin. I'm like, I'm new. But that is beautiful. And I actually met a professional bird watcher. He goes, birding tours? I said, that sounds like a fun job. And he goes, well, you get a lot of egos. In bird watching? And he told me guys will brag about how many birds they've seen. And the best part is how they verify they've seen a bird is they just say that they did. It's an honor code, so I've seen every bird. Prove I haven't. Oh, yeah? Where'd you see the cinnamon-breasted toady tyrant? Denver. They only live in Tasmania. Yeah, I was surprised. I was like, weird, here? check. But then I realized you could have more fun with an arrogant birder if you went too low with your number. They're all bragging. You're just like, that's cool. I've only seen two birds. Well, you've seen more than two birds. I wish. It's just been pigeons and crows for me. How long have you been birding? 4 years. So bad at it. I've seen chicken nuggets, if that counts. Have a feeling it doesn't. PETA is trying to remove animal violence from figures of speech, and they want us to stop saying kill two birds with one stone and start saying feed two birds with one scone. Which is so cute, and I can almost see that making sense. I want to just implement it with no context. Hey, while you're getting gas, could you grab some milk too? Feed two birds with one scone. What? Just grab some milk with the gas. Two birds, one scone. But I happen to know most birds are gluten intolerant, so you could actually feed two birds one scone and kill two birds with one scone. Or at least make them very ill. And I don't know if you can tell by looking at me, but I worked in a coffee shop for 2 years. Happen to know that scones get rock hard about 5 hours after they were fresh. So you could actually kill two birds with one scone, stone style as well. There's more than one way to skin a cat. When it comes to killing multiple birds with singular pastries.
That was Joe Zimmerman in today's Comedy Corner with a piece called Birdwatching, taken from a club appearance in Denver a while back. Now it's time to talk with Amy Crosby about St. Francis Society Animal Rescue and an upcoming benefit event that's going to serve them as well. Let's hear more about both by welcoming Amy Crosby to Talking Animals on WMNF. Good morning, Amy.
Hi.
Thanks for joining us on Talking Animals this morning.
Great. Thank you for having me.
Sure. So let's start with maybe an overview of St. Francis Rescue Animal, St. Francis Society, I'm sorry, St. Francis Society Animal Rescue.
Yes.
Its history of it and mission and, you know, that kind of thing.
Sure. Yeah. We've been around since 1997, and our mission is to save the lives of sick, injured, and stray cats and dogs in Tampa Bay. We have a very robust foster program where we placed over 1,700 animals last year. In addition to that, we help prevent cat overpopulation by doing something called trap, neuter, return, where we sterilize the stray cats in the neighborhood and then return them to feeding colonies. And we spay, neuter, and return about 1,500 animals a year, all to help prevent animals from being born and ending up in shelters.
Wow, those are big numbers in both cases, the fostering numbers and the TNR numbers. That's a lot of work. How big a crew? I know this is all pretty much, if I'm not mistaken, volunteer-oriented. So how many people are working to kind of achieve those results?
Yes, we are in a foster-based program. We don't have a shelter. All the animals live in our homes until they're put up for adoption, and then we use some local stores just for the weekend to get them adopted, but they all live in our homes. And we have about over 200 active volunteers right now.
That's great.
And we do serve a very wide area. We are all the way from Pinellas County, St. Pete, all the way up to Newport Richey area, and all the way out to Brandon, Riverview, and Gibsonton.
Wow, you're blanketing the area, Amy, it sounds like to me.
Yeah. We are doing our best to help stop the cat and dog overpopulation and help those poor stray animals.
Yeah, well, it sounds like, again, whatever you're doing, it sounds like it's very effective given those numbers. So there's no facility of its own, as you note, but I guess you use stores, pet stores. Is that how the animals that get adopted out that have been fostered?
Yes, yes. You have a website, so you can come look at animals on our website, and some people will let you come to their homes to see them. But we do also operate in three different PetSmart stores. We're at the PetSmart in South Tampa, the one in Brandon on Causeway Boulevard, and also the one in Citrus Park Mall. In addition to that, we're at two different Pet Supplies Plus, the one in St. Pete and the one in Land O'Lakes, and at two pet supermarkets, one in Brandon, one in Ruskin, and we also work out of the Petco in Carrollwood. So we are usually there on the weekends with live pet events, and some of these stores have built-in kennels where we're able to keep animals for quite a few days where people can go meet them in person. And all that's listed on our website.
Well, that's fantastic. And that sounds like quite a few outposts where people can go and meet some cats and hopefully take one home.
Yes, yes, that would be great. They all have an opportunity for you to meet the kitties. We kind of match a good one to what you're looking for. And then there's usually a space there where you can sit down and have some playtime with the cat, too. So you can make sure there's a good connection there.
So, Amy, let me ask you this. When all is said and done, is St. Francis Society Animal Rescue really more of a cat rescue, even though it seems like you're open to helping dogs as well?
We do a lot more cats than dogs, only because the need is greater, but we do place a lot of dogs as well, and they are also kept in our foster homes. We do about 15 to 20 dogs a year as well. They are not at the stores, though. None of the stores in this area allow us to have dogs there, at least our rescue. So at the stores, we mostly have cats. But all of our dogs are available on our website, and you're able to meet them in person as well at the foster's home where they're staying.
Well, that sounds great. And what if somebody hearing this said, hey, I'd like to join the ranks of those volunteers, sound like you're doing good work. How about someone get involved, or just even if they wanted to financially support the work of St. Francis Society Animal Rescue?
We would totally welcome any of that. We go through, as you can imagine, quite a bit of cat food every year and a lot of kitten food. The best thing to do is to go to our website, which is stfrancisrescue.org. And on there, you can fill out an application to be a volunteer. And we need volunteers to be fosters, of course, but we also need people to help us at the events at stores. We also have people that just do transport for us. They're sort of like an Uber for kittens. If you like to drive in the Bay Area and want to help us get animals to their intended targets, that would be great. And also there's ways to donate and help us out. We have an Amazon wish list where you can donate food directly to us. And we're always open to, you know, cash or monetary donations as well.
Well, that sounds great. And I like the idea of being an Uber for a cat. That sounds like a good gig. So, well, speaking of other ways that help kind of support the operation, let's talk a little bit about this upcoming event, Life Amplified Perfect. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, so Life Amplified has generously donated their services to have an event for us on November 1st. It's going to be at the Carrollwood Cultural Center, and it's from 8 to 10 p.m., and they have lined up an amazing event with all kinds of things. There's going to be photos of adoptable cats that you can look at and adopt. We're having live singers from different Bay Area stages. Metropolitan Improv and Comedian is going to be there. There's dancing. There's going to be a charcuterie table with snacks for everyone, a balloon arch, and lots of our volunteers as well as other cat lovers there. It's a black and white feline themed costume ball, so you can be decked out in your favorite black and white cat themed outfits.
So I guess that's open to interpretation. I guess it could suggest it's a tuxedo cat, but it doesn't necessarily have to, I guess.
No, but that's a good one. I didn't even think of that. Yes, come as your best tuxedo cat. But yes, any cat at all or any feline themed, you know, t-shirts or outfits that you have, I'm sure there'll be some very creative outfits there.
And then the proceeds from that night, if I'm not mistaken, do go to St. Francis Society Animal Rescue.
They do. Like I said, Life Amplified is generously giving all the proceeds to us. It's $15 for a single ticket and $25 per couple. All ages are welcome. And I'm sorry, it's 18 and up, but it is alcohol free and everyone is welcome. And so we're also going to have Miss Florida USA there. So we have quite a few different people in entertainment to keep everyone occupied. And, of course, all of it will be directly helping our animals by all the proceeds going to us to help us buy the tons of cat food we go through every year.
Wow, well, that sounds like a lot going on just to cram into just 2 hours of the event itself. That sounds like it's going to be a never dull moment that night, November 1st there for Perfect.
Yes, yes, it should be a lot of fun. I hope we can see you there.
Well, I'm gonna start thinking about my black and white outfit right now. So I'm going to go from there. So, Amy, thanks so much for joining us today on Talking Animals, and keep up the great work with the rescuing the cats and occasionally the dogs. And hope people come out to the event and they can find out more about that. Probably also on your website, or is there a dedicated specific website for the Perfect event?
They can go to Life Amplified also for more information.
Okay.
And get tickets there. And I think there'll probably be tickets available at the door as well. But yes, you can go to our website for more information also. And that's stfrancisrescue.org. And thank you so much for having us on here to talk about our organization and the event that's coming up.
For sure. My pleasure. You're doing great, great work. I always try to support that. So thanks again for making the time to join us today and tell us all about it.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye.
Coming up on WNF, it's The Conversation, the great show hosted by Mario Nunez and Joe King Carter. After that, it's The Scoop, WNF's brief news recap. Then we shift back to music programming with Sam Vall, holding forth from 1 to 3, followed by Nancy C, hosting the traffic jam from 3 to 6. And then it's just all much more of just great music all day long after that on 88.5 WNF. We have just about reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals. Next Wednesday, October 8th, as a reminder, I'll be joined by the fabulous Flea and the fabulous Bev Capshaw. We'll be raising money for WNF that morning, trying to reach the giant goal. Talking Animals has been assigned. So please help us get a head start. While you're thinking about it right now, well, maybe just make an early pledge. Go to WMNF.org. Just follow the prompts for donating. Just please be sure to designate that your donation goes to TLA Talking Animals. There's a drop-down menu and you'll see TLA Talking Animals. So that would really be a huge help. Just give a running start. Either way, I hope you'll join us next Wednesday because we'll have a lot of fun, some great music and some comedy. And again, it'll be Flea, Bev, and myself trying to raise money for WMNF that day. So meanwhile, I also invite you to visit TalkAnimals.net for audio archives of every show we've ever done, and Apple Podcasts are there too, as well as other podcast platforms, and the links to our social media pages, etc. All that and more is at TalkAnimals.net. So, thanks again for listening today. Stay tuned for conversation and more great programming after that. Again, we're going to switch back to music with Sam. So, have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. This is Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa, Brandon, Clearwater, Largo, Weekiwachee, and beyond. We'll see you next Wednesday here at 11 a.m. on Talking Animals on WMNF. Stay tuned for The Conversation coming up momentarily after NPR News headlines. Thanks so much. Take care.